It's Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Ben Ennis and Arash Madani and the Canadian athletes will be going to the Olympics. The American athletes will be going to the Olympics, but Canadian diplomats will not. Canada, a diplomatic boycott of the upcoming Olympic Games in Beijing. Let's talk to Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News. Cormac, thanks for doing this. So just simply, what does this mean?
Essentially, this only applies to government officials. So no government officials, no ministers of sport or staff from the government are going to be heading over to Beijing for the Games. While it probably won't impact the athletes themselves and what they're planning to do there, it sends a clear message to China politically that Canada doesn't agree with their human rights record. There have been violations from the attempted genocide of the Uyghur Muslims to, you know, the suppression of democracy in Hong Kong and you know, more clearly and domestically for Canada, the arbitrary detention of the two Michaels, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, who spent almost 3 years in Chinese jail cells over this Meng Wanzhou Huawei dispute that involved the United States. So the U.S. was the first to announce this, saying they were going to do a diplomatic boycott earlier this week. The conversations have been ongoing for a long time between Canada and its allies. And just this morning, we heard Australia, the United Kingdom, and Lithuania, you know, other allies of ours are also going to be doing this diplomatic boycott. And then the Prime Minister came out and said that they would be doing it as well. So it's very largely a political statement, but it does raise some questions for our athletes about whether, you know, this could be a distraction or even a security concern.
And that's the real question here. What's the pushback to the athletes, to the coaches, to the staff? And Cormac, we've been hearing about the potential of a diplomatic boycott for a while now. It's been a number of weeks. What's your sense on any apprehension the government may have had leading into this, and what they may feel the brushback, if any, could be for some of the credentialed personnel wearing Team Canada stuff in Beijing?
Well, on the first question about timing of all of this, you know, this has been going on for months, these conversations. There have been meetings internationally where these things got raised. There have been questions about China's human rights records since the games were announced in Beijing. So, you know, there have been a lot of questions about whether people would be taking part. There were larger questions earlier about whether athletes would, whether the country as a whole would do a whole boycott. But, you know, there was that situation with the two Michaels, which made it politically tricky for Canada, because you didn't want to anger China when they had two of our citizens in this high-profile case,
right,
and you didn't know what was going to happen with them. You know, China can execute people for what they said was espionage. You know, most likely it was going to be life imprisonment if they had gotten to that point, but eventually, you know, just this past September, the two Michaels were released. Then it was coordinating with allies to see how they would be able to institute such a boycott to send a message to China. And, you know, when you get, it's almost too many cooks in the kitchen. It'd be easy if it was just Canada on its own saying, yep, we're doing this. But when you're bringing in all these other allies to try and have a coordinated effort on this, it takes a lot of behind-the-scenes coordination. So it took some time, but the U.S. made its announcement earlier this week. They were the big power to really step forward. And once they did that, you know, it became a little bit easier for Canada to come out and say it as well. But we're definitely seeing some of the allies in the G7 do this. But we haven't heard all of them yet. They haven't all come out in support of a diplomatic boycott. And so those conversations continue. Canada's foreign affairs minister says she's going to continue to talk to other countries like France and Italy to join in on this. In terms of what the impact might be for the athletes on the ground, that's a big question. Look, China, when the U.S. made this first announcement, came out with very strong language against the Americans. They're threatening consequences, countermeasures. In fact, one of their foreign ministry spokespeople said the U.S. will pay a price for this decision. What is that price? We don't know. Are they talking about trade issues? Are they talking about arbitrary detentions, which is something, you know, we know well about here in Canada, given the situation with the two Michaels? And that is a concern. The Prime Minister was asked about it. What does this mean in terms of retaliation from China? He said China shouldn't be surprised by this move, given what they've heard from Canada and its allies recently. But at the same time, he did note that arbitrary detention, like we saw with the two Michaels, is a concern. And so, security.
Nuts. This is absolutely nuts. Like, what are we talking about here?
I mean, I want to win a gold medal, but enough that I would risk being detained in a Chinese jail cell. It would be a tough call, Cormac.
Golly.
I mean, it would be egregious for China to do that to athletes attending the Beijing Games. So, you know, you would think maybe they're talking about something else for paying the price, but it is something that is of a concern. You want to make sure that your athletes are kept safe. And the foreign affairs minister did say today that, as in past games, there have been conversations between the Olympic Committee and the RCMP about protective services for our athletes. And that's definitely going to be happening in this case.
Well, you mentioned the possibility of an actual boycott, not sending athletes to these games. And do you think that this was ever a real consideration? Did the federal government actually have the ability, the power to enact that? Was there political pressure to actually do that?
Well, the government said, and there was some pressure to potentially do that. There were some initially calling for a full boycott of this, but then it seemed like some of those calls started to pull back to a diplomatic boycott. But, you know, there are people who do believe, given the human rights record of China, that we shouldn't be rewarding them in any sense by sending athletes over there. And this is a battle in these situations where athletes have trained for years, gone to international competitions to make it to this point to win that gold medal for their country. And some athletes, I don't think, would be too happy about spending all of that effort, most of their days striving towards this goal, and then for that to be denied over political issues.
Yeah, and also, Cormac, not to interrupt, but they've been down this road in 1980 and 1984,
mm-hmm.
and nothing got achieved other than the athletes being penalized, and only the athletes were penalized.
Yeah, I think that's one consideration. I mean, the prime minister did say they don't want to penalize the athletes, essentially. He didn't use those exact terms, but he said that they've been training for years and they're going to support our athletes going for gold, like 100%. So that was taken off the table today with the prime minister. And I think there were indications anyway earlier that that was not on the table for Canada. And I don't think any country so far has said that they're doing a full, complete boycott of these games.
No.
So we're still going to have the athletes competing. There are going to be some security concerns. And understandably for Canada, given what's happened over the last 3 years, we will be concerned about that come February when the games begin. But, you know, moving forward, this is an attempt to be to make a political point mm-hmm. with China. And the question will be whether we see any impact at the games, whether that's the athletes themselves or the staff with the athletes. And I will point out that when it comes to a boycott of athletes, I think the government made a big separation early on in that discussion, saying that's a question for the Olympic Committee. They're the ones who will make the decision about whether athletes go or not, not the government. And so I think giving that separation gave the government a little bit of wiggle room away from those questions. But when it comes to a diplomatic boycott and what the government does, they've already made it clear what they're going to do. And I guess the question is whether it's even going to achieve a lot, given the fact that we're not going to be sending like a delegation of 40 different ministers out to the Beijing Games. It would usually be a handful of people likely, but nonetheless, it's more symbolic. And if the goal was to stand up to China, given China's reaction to the U.S. boycott, it seems to be working, I guess.
Yeah, that it feels like window dressing, honestly, Cormac, that it's, okay, you get a positive news cycle, and I guess it's a bipartisan issue, right? Like, everybody in Ottawa can link arms and say we're all in this together, but ultimately, the actual impact is minimal, it feels like.
But it could also be a moral stand, just saying, look, we just can't morally send our government officials over there, given everything that's happened with China over the last 3 years and more in terms of their human rights violation. This is not a new issue when it comes to human rights with China. Questions have been raised over previous games in China. So these questions get brought up with the Olympics every time they're in a place that has issues, and it's not new. We've dealt with this times before, as you said, you know, with athletes being denied access to the games, There were questions about, you know, who, what really was achieved out of that. But the diplomatic one is a political message to be sent, and it's being sent, and clearly it's being heard by China given their reaction.
Cormac, I don't know if you know the answers to either of these questions, but we're 2 months away, give or take like a minute, from the cauldron being lit in Beijing. Do you get any sense that the Canadian federal government will be doing anything else in addition to this diplomatic boycott? And do you foresee any scenario in which the boycott could be lifted between now and early February?
Last part first, I don't think there would be a scenario where we would see the diplomatic boycott lifted. I mean, I've been surprised in politics before, but it seems highly unlikely. China's not the superpower that tends to give in to these sorts of things.
Right.
When they're challenged, they get their backs up. So the Chinese government is likely not going to say, oh, these boycotts mean, sure, we're going to, you know, stop doing all the things that you have issues with in terms of, you know, attempted genocide and issues like that. So I don't think that's going to happen. In terms of what the federal government may do in between now and the games and whether there could be more action, I'm not sure whether there would be in regards to the games themselves, but there is this other issue that's sort of hanging over all of this, and that is the decision about whether Huawei Technologies should have access to Canada's 5G networks. Mm. The government has been thinking this over for a very long time, didn't make a decision when the whole Huawei Two Michaels scenario was going on for obvious reasons. Again, you know, you had two citizens who were facing some serious, a serious scenario, languishing in Chinese jail cells, and they didn't want to rock the boat too much. This Huawei decision, you know, we're still expecting it. It was supposed to come down by now. A lot of our allies have already banned Huawei from 5G, but Canada has yet to do that. So whether we get that announcement before the games or not, we were supposed to be getting it before the end of this year. But it's, you know, they've delayed this decision many, many times in the past. So whether they delay it again, we'll see. Mm-hmm. But if they do announce this decision and it doesn't go the way that China wants, you know, that could further create tensions with China ahead of the games.
Well, you said it, Cormac. This is not generally a superpower that backs down. It seems like they've made their line in the sand. And as much as the international community would like to apply pressure, it hasn't worked in the past. I'm hopeful that it will work, but I'm not exactly expecting that. And this feels kind of precedent setting. That, I mean, this is the second games in China in 14 years, as you referenced, 2008, that if there is another sporting event that the international community is called on to arrive in China, that we can't send diplomats again. That now that you've set this precedent, unless something changes, it doesn't feel like this country can send diplomats to China for any sporting reason.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I guess it's a case-by-case basis as to how it's going to work moving forward. If if there are other major events that end up taking place there, you know, I think strength in numbers is what Canada and the allies are looking for right now, that they can send a message to China that things can't continue as they are, as the White House press secretary said, like, this is not going to be business as usual, and they're trying to send that message to China that they want to see changes. If you have a lot of countries on board with this diplomatic boycott, look, China, you know, as much as it's run by a communist party, is very heavily invested in capitalism. There's a lot of money that goes through China, a lot of business dealings. Yeah. And as one Chinese expert told me a long time ago during the Two Michaels scenario, money talks. Mm-hmm. And one way to get through to China is to have Canadian businesses or American businesses on board with pulling business out of China if they really wanted to send a message. So, you know, there are different avenues that they can do to try and send messages to China. And I guess, you know, to come back to the original point of all of this, when it comes to sporting events, there are ways that we can send messages to China politically that don't always have to involve the athletes who are taking part in, you know, whether it be the Olympics or a World Cup, whatever it may be.
Going to be an interesting couple of months leading up to this thing, and then an interesting couple of weeks as well. Cormac, we really appreciate the time. Thanks for this.
Anytime.
There's Cormac McSweeney,
Parliament Hill bureau chief for City News, and it's something, which is better than nothing, I suppose. And I've talked to Stephen about this, and you brought it up in the conversation with Cormac, that an actual boycott doesn't accomplish all that much except for ruining the Olympic dreams of hundreds of athletes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to do something, this is the thing that you're going to do. But overall, I don't know. Hard to imagine being all that impactful. And in fact, it makes things a little bit hairy for the athletes that are going over there. And really, like, the potential for retaliation, whether it's during these Olympic Games or beyond, is a frightening thought.
I wonder if the United States government had not come out and done this first, do the other countries, including Canada, follow suit?
No way. No way. This is Canada's doesn't feel like a leader on this. Everybody just has to line up behind the United States.
It almost felt like they were just kind of talking around it and hoping they wouldn't have to make a decision on it.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll likely never know if there are any ramifications from this for the Canadian delegation, if there are going to be hardships, etc. Yes, in a lot of ways, this is symbolic. There's no question. But what Cormac didn't know, what none of us know, there are 2 months left with so many question marks still remaining about the actual very existence of how this whole thing is going to unfold once people get there. I wonder if there's another move politically by the Western world towards China. I don't know.
Well, maybe. The reason I'm skeptical about that is because this is largely symbolic, and it took a while for this to even be enacted, right? Like, there's yeah. really not a whole lot to this. Hey, China is bad. Don't send your vice president to China. Well, that seems like a pretty cut and dried conversation. Well, it took weeks and weeks, if not months, to have that enacted. But maybe. I also wonder what the impact of the WTA stance and Steve Simon saying, we're not going to China, a couple of weeks ago, whether that started this whole ball rolling. Because I mentioned it there to Cormac as well. Once you've set a precedent that China's bad, and until they're not bad or less bad, you know, we kind of can't send delegates to sporting events. Once the WTA says, hey, we're not going to put our sport in your country until we can have access to Peng Shui, whether that was a momentum setter for this?
It's a good question. I don't think it is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. I really don't. And look, the IOC is just going to do IOC things because they're as gross as they get.
Did you see the IOC today, by the way? Not to cut you off, but the IOC, I mean, it wasn't great, but they did acknowledge that there is some unanswered questions. They weren't as definitive about Peng Shui being fully accounted for in their comment today.
Which is wild when you consider the IOC said, no. Peng Shui did a video call with the head of the IOC, mm-hmm. and we're all good.
You can't see any of it.
There just feels like there's something else coming. There feels like there has to be some. It can't just, like, the sense you get is there just won't be only a diplomatic boycott. And then, okay, all systems go, you know, we've wiped our hands of it clean, onwards.
Mm.
There just feels that there's another move here somehow, somewhere that may lead to more spillover before February 7th.
Well, the thing that comes to mind when you say that is athlete individual protests, right? Protests at the games, whether that's on a medal podium or whether that's in the mix zone in a conversation with a member of the media, and what the fallout might be of that. That's the thing I think about. I wonder whether we get into some very scary situations if that takes place. Now, again, it was not long ago. We had an Olympics in China in 2008. They weren't great dudes then. They weren't the beacon of shining light when it came to human rights in 2008. Maybe it's gotten worse since then.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't recall. Perhaps, you know, people are more aware of what's happening in that country now. But I don't recall any massive protests in 2008.
Look, if they really cared about this thing,
The IOC is hopeless and you can forget it. If this was really going to be an issue that the world of sport was going to get behind, every single governing body of every single sport that's represented the Olympics, FIFA, ITF, FIBA, International Wrestling, on and on we could go. Every single one would follow suit and say, we will not host an international world competition in China moving forward. How many have? Zero. One professional association, the WTA, has so far, Peng Shui being the poster. Are we allowed to say poster child?
That's, sure.
Yeah. Being the face of this movement. And they're saying it now, which is strong, because if the WTA is coming out and saying this and they have a tournament in Shanghai, they are going to alienate China and they're going to alienate some of their sponsors there. Unless the WTA comes crawling back next fall and says, no, we want to go to Shanghai because there's a lot of money in there for us. They have an 11-month runway between now and then.
Yeah, I mean, to me, you've set yourself, you've taken a stance and you've been so vociferous and you have been so black and white that you have to follow through or you look like an absolute clown if nothing is resolved, because there's been opportunities where you could have backed down.
But
things
have changed. Peng Shui is fine. Well, our athletes have spoken. We've seen the IOC go there. Etc. Etc.
Maybe I would just say, if that was your plan or your a possibility that there were opportunities to take that route in the last couple of weeks, and instead they've been more emboldened and they've been more steadfast. So, yeah. Again, I feel like I'm, as a person that's very cynical in my real life, I feel like on this show I'm like the second most cynical guy every time I sit down here. Not just Steven, and now you. Come on. You know, have some hope, have some faith that goodness will prevail, Arash.
I mean, we're talking about the WTA. Understand this, though, Ben, is that they were doing their World Tour Finals, their showcase event,
right,
in China until COVID sent it away, only because of the guaranteed money they were going to get there. Not to grow their game globally. The time zone there is brutal, as we all know, for no other reason but money. For them to now come and do a complete 180 on this issue, that's why I have skepticism. There is nothing that we have seen from any professional tennis governing body, the International Tennis Federation, the ATP, the men's side, the Association of Tennis Professionals, the WTA. At no point until this only scenario with China have we seen any leadership or any outlook for the greater good from these three governing bodies, for the greater good of the game and the sport and the athletes. It has solely been a cash grab and a narrow-sighted series of decisions. They have destroyed the Davis Cup. They destroyed what was the Federation Cup, then Fed Cup. Now they call it the Billie Jean King Cup. They have created a scenario where there's a 3 or 4 week off season for the athletes. They have turned anybody ranked 75 or below in the rankings to effectively breaking even from a prize money standpoint. And at every turn, when players are trying to create a union of their own or a players association of their own, they are creating roadblocks. But suddenly, politically, the Peng Shui thing comes up. The WTA, that had done nothing in support of her in the lead up to this announcement, has said, we're not going to China.
Well, again, I choose to have the optimistic viewpoint that Steve Simon is actually trying to save a human life. And that is like, it's different than like the theory of China. And yes, I understand that China was still China when they decided to go there the first time and for the billions of dollars. But I think it's different when you're actually talking about a person who might be have a better chance of returning to an perhaps non-imprisoned life, or literally saving her life if you take action.
And I just wonder how many of the players said, yeah, we're just not going there.
Yeah, that might be part of it too. It might have been an easy sell.
All right. When we come back, we will talk to a legendary sports columnist for the Boston Globe, author of Wish It Lasted Forever, Life with the Larry Bird Celtics, Dan Shaughnessy. Will get into Bill Belichick and perhaps Bill Belichick against Tom Brady in a Super Bowl. ESPN has it as its most likely Super Bowl matchup. That'd be a thing. Dan Shaughnessy next. Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Ennis, Arash Madani, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Ben Ennis and Arash Madani. And Sean McDermott didn't want to give Bill Belichick all the credit in the world after Monday's 14-10 quote-unquote football game. Right. But yeah, whatever. Bills are hanging on for dear life in the AFC playoff race, while the New England Patriots are atop the entire conference. Let's talk to Dan Shaughnessy, sports columnist for the Boston Globe and author of Wish It Lasted Forever, Life with the Larry Bird Celtics. Thanks for doing this, Dan.
Thank you guys for having me.
So Sean McDermott didn't want to give Belichick credit, like I mentioned. How much do you believe he should receive for Monday's game plan?
Yeah, that was an unfortunate performance by the head coach of the Buffalo Bills. I mean, it was almost Nixonian. You know, it's like you won't have Nixon to kick around anymore. It was like defensive. He did not need to bring that up. It was unfortunate. And I thought he got pantsed in that game. And I thought it was, you know, embarrassing. And why bring attention to it? So they got another crack at him in 2 weeks. And hopefully it'll work out for them then. But that was not a good start.
You know, Dan, I was thinking about it after the game. And still, you know, sitting on the couch thinking to myself, did New England just improve to 9-4 with their quarterback attempting 3 passes? And I thought to myself, if Brady were still the quarterback under Belichick, how many passes is he actually going to attempt in that game? What do you think?
It's a really good question. It's a really good question because Tom's all about showing off and throwing and having a million passes. And he threw 50 last week, and first drive was 13 passes, 13 plays. That's all he cares about, and good for him. And it works. It's a formula that's working. So I think it would have been hard for him to subjugate his ego and play along on that. I don't know. And, of course, Josh Allen threw 30 passes, so it was doable in that situation. But this was the strategy that they played. I was like, bring on the leather helmets for the fourth quarter this game. Like, it was a perfect Belichick game, and it worked, and it was a little bit hard in the eyes for some people, but I was laughing my butt off watching that game.
Yeah, I just wonder if Brady is the quarterback, they attempt 3 passes but lose 17-14. What mushroom cloud erupts out of New England after that? If it unfolded that way,
point. And it speaks to how unhappy it was here the last few years, and you know they had all that success and it was great, but at the end it really wasn't great, and even they went 8-0. In 2019, Tom's last year, but it was a very unhappy 8-0, and of course, it went south on him toward the end, and Tom was displeased with the weapons and the attack and what they were doing, and it was time for everybody to move on. So they did, and here we are. Now you got a possibility. It's still remote, but it is a possibility that they could face one another in the Super Bowl, which would be great.
Oh, it would, and we'll get to that in just a second. I do want to go back to Mac Jones for just a second here, because Mac Jones does attempt just the 3 passes. His odds to be Offensive Rookie of the Year actually improved after that performance. They won the football game, sure. Where do you land on the hype surrounding Mac Jones, that he's been the most successful of the first round quarterbacks, but is he overhyped? Like, where do you think the truth lies with him?
Well, he came to a perfect situation. I mean, you know, 4 guys picked ahead of him, and, you know, nobody's fault. And we'll never know how much of that was luck or by design or known. But whatever, it happened. And we still didn't know in the preseason, because Bill played Cam Newton. He started him in all 3 preseason games, so we did not know where this was going. And I think they saw enough. But if they knew going in that Jones was the quarterback, he would have started all 3 preseason games. So Cam basically lost the job. Mm-hmm. And I think Bill hates rookie quarterbacks, but he was forced to play his hand in this. And they've made the most of it. And I mean, a little bit inadvertent, but hey, knock yourself out. It's like for Mac Jones, he came to the perfect place. If he were with the Jets, he would not be having this kind of success. It's the coaching. It's the system. It's the management. It's protecting the young guy and not having to do too much. And they've also got a really good defense, which, of course, enables the guy to play conservative and safe like that.
Is Mac Jones a Bill Belichick quarterback? Is that what we've found here? Is this the?
I think that's true. And don't forget, you saw a game on Monday. There was no quarterback. I mean, they won without a quarterback. And Bill does not believe in the position being overemphasized, and that was part of the problem with Tom, is that you had a coach who does not value the position as much as he values, you know, special teams. I mean, he loves certain things, and high-profile quarterbacking is not one of them. Game management is enough for him, and this is giving him a chance to flex his coach muscle and do that. And thus far, it's working. We'll see where it takes him.
Yeah, and I don't want to put the cart before the horse, but the Patriots are atop the AFC right now with a rookie quarterback a year after they were out of the playoffs, but only 7-9, but with the decaying corpse of Cam Newton. Like, if the Patriots win the AFC, if the Patriots end up in a Super Bowl this year, whether they win it or lose it, where would this rank in Bill Belichick's greatest achievements?
Ooh. I mean, you know, I think that the 2001 team, you know, they were, you know, 5-11 in 2000, and then of course they won the Super Bowl in 2001 and beat the greatest show on turf, and they were big underdogs, I think top two or three underdogs in the history of the game. So yeah, I think that that's always going to be number one. But you certainly, if they were to win the Super Bowl with this, then you got a strong contender that this is it.
Yeah, where would that? Okay, so now we're going to go beyond just the Patriots in the Super Bowl. We're going to talk about the Patriots against the Buccaneers in the Super Bowl, which is actually the odds-on favorite to be the matchup today.
Right.
As somebody that was sick of the Patriots and Tom Brady being in a Super Bowl, I could actually very much get amped up for that Super Bowl matchup. Where would that rank in the all-time most anticipated sporting events?
I mean, it's in our town, that's probably it. I mean, you know, the Red Sox-Yankee thing in 03-04 had so much buildup. But I'll tell you, given the popularity of the NFL today and the Patriot dynasty of the last 20 years and the way it ended and Tom's winning the Super Bowl last year, I mean, it's hard to say that that's not wouldn't be the top thing. It's still hypothetical, but yeah, it's right. It's certainly in the running.
Longtime Boston Globe columnist Dan Shaughnessy joins us. He is the author of the new book, Wish It Lasted Forever, Life with the Larry Bird Celtics. Dan, I grew up a fan of the Showtime Lakers. And I told Kevin McHale this once at the NBA Finals in 2019. I said, Kevin, I was scared out of my mind whenever 33 came on the floor, but I just couldn't stand you. It was such a unique Celtics team. I thought Pat Riley summed it up best. He said, if I needed to pick someone to hit a shot to win a game, I'd take Michael Jordan. If I needed someone to hit a shot to save my life, I'd pick Larry Bird. When you think back to that 80s group, these days where everyone's talking about the GOAT, they talk about LeBron, they talk about Jordan, they forget about the Showtime Lakers, they forget about the 80s Celtics, let alone Bill Russell with his 11 rings and Wilt Chamberlain. What's your biggest takeaway from being part of that traveling roadshow with the Boston Celtics all those years?
Well, it was a unique time. That's why I wrote the book. I mean, everybody knows who won, who's in the Hall of Fame, what the stats are, and Celtics, Lakers, and all that. But this was a time, it was different in the NBA. The NBA was getting on its feet. NBA, you know, finals were on tape delay in those days, and the league had drug problems, and teams were losing money. But the whole thing turned around when Bird and Magic came to the league in 79. The Celtics, Lakers, Bird, Magic finals were the Ali Frazier of the NBA, put it on the map. And then Jordan comes along in 84 and it accelerates to the dream team and the global entity that it is today. So all this got going in the Bird Celtic years. And these guys were supremely confident in their abilities. Those Laker matches were, again, epic. And Riley's right. And Bird was a force. I'm actually standing on the floor of the Boston Garden right now. There's an event tonight where Kevin McHale is being honored. I'll tell him you guys said hello.
Please do.
And,
yeah.
This is a legacy that lives on in our market. And those guys, it was a privilege for me to be able to cover them. And in those days, we traveled with them. They flew commercials, stayed in Holiday Inns, waited for bags, hotel bars, on the bus to practice. It was like being part of the team. And we were able to tell the fans what the players were like. That was a supremely unique, confident group of individuals, and they maximized it. You know, in 1985, 86, they went 50-1 at home. They had five Hall of Famers. They won the championship. They were in the finals five times. They won three. So, again, just a great time in the sport, and that's why I wrote the book. And to this day, it's just great to think fondly back on those days.
Dan, generally when I hear athletes of bygone eras talk about how much better they would be in the current era, I roll my eyes. Yeah. And not to say that Larry Bird has ever said this to my knowledge, but he comes into the league in 79-80, which I think is the first year that the three-point line exists. I mean, it's hard not to think about what he would have been in an era in which you can take double-digit three-point attempts. How do you think his game would have translated to today's game?
It's a really good question. Bird took two a game. I mean, you know, Harden's taking whatever, like you say, double digits a game, and it's just it was a weapon, but it was not the weapon. They hadn't done the analytics and figured out the metrics and all that, so there was much more flow. It was a more fun game to watch. The pick and rolls, the you know, low post game, high post game, just the fluid passing and what they had. So I think it translates. It's all in the book. I talked to McHale about it. And, you know, he says, well, we would compete in any era if you let us play by the rules of the 80s when they were kicking the crap out of each other in the low block. And, of course, did not rely on the threes. You didn't have guys just launching from international waters repeatedly. And Rick Carlisle is a big player in the book because he played in that team that I referenced, the team that won the championship in 85, 86. He's been a coach in the league for a long, long time, won a championship. He understands what translates. And that team had outside shooters, Bird, Scott Wedman, Jerry Seasting, Danny Ainge. They had 7 feet people, Robert Parrish, Bill Walton, Kevin McHale. So I think it translates to any era. It was more fun to watch, in my view. I understand Kevin Durant, what these guys do today, but I think, you know, good basketball is good basketball. And we're not talking about Bob Cousy and Bill Schrammer from the 50s. We're talking about guys who had great long range shooting and big people who could, you know, bang it down low.
The book is Wish It Lasted Forever, Life with the Larry Bird Celtics. Dan Shaughnessy, the author. Dan, thanks for doing this.
Enjoyed it. Take care, fellas.
Yeah, you too. Dan Shaughnessy. You know what I'm talking about, Arash? Because you hear this all the time. The old players talking about how, oh, our team, we would have just mopped the floor with
in
this.
In my day.
And generally... Yeah, I mean, anybody that's seen a hockey game played 30 years ago, that's like, you can't, it doesn't look like the same sport that's being mm-hmm. played today. It's the case with football as well. I mean, West Coast offense and, you know, the proliferation of passing has changed the way it looks. The NBA.
But also nutrition and equipment.
Well,
and
human evolution.
Right.
That I would hope that the human body is getting better, if not worse, or else we're in trouble.
Talking to Greg Millen, and Millen, for those who don't remember, before he was a hockey analyst, he was a goaltender in the NHL for Hartford and the Quebec Nordiques and a couple other teams. And I asked him about, you know, early in his career, because we're talking about travel in the NHL today. He's talking about, you know, charters and everything. He said, you know, when I was a rookie, on a back-to-back, we had to take the first commercial flight out. So you're on like a 7 a.m. flight. Right. So you got to be at the airport for 5 with all your stuff after a game. And as a rookie, I'm playing the second leg of a back-to-back. And because I'm a rookie, I get relegated to the back of the plane, middle seat, in the smoking section. So here I am trying to get a couple hours of sleep on the plane before I'm playing a National Hockey League game, starting a game as a goaltender, mm-hmm. and dudes in suits, businessmen going from, you know, LaGuardia to Chicago are blowing cigarette smoke in my face. Times have changed.
They have.
Yeah.
I've been on a flight where there's been smoking allowed. I've been on an Air Mexicana flight, and it was a mind bender to be sure. But yeah, okay. So that's generally the case when you talk to old time players. That yeah, okay. They didn't have the advantages of today, but also the game was different, and players are much better now. That being said, the Larry Bird 3-point shot thing is super interesting because he was a great 3-point shooter. Basically, the outset of 3-point shooting mm-hmm. in the NBA. Like, no, had never been done before because why do it? The 3-point line exists in his rookie year in the NBA. It would just, and maybe he has a different workout regimen as well this day and age, but it would be like, that's the one case where people can make it to me and I will buy it. Hey, you know what? Maybe Larry Bird might have been just as good in this day and age.
Yeah, Bird's recovery of six Budweisers mm-hmm. is a little different than the protein shake, cold tub, hot tub, and stretch.
Right.
And I mean this sincerely.
Okay.
Like, I disliked Larry Bird immensely as a kid. In my, like, peak basketball fandom, I was terrified of him. Larry Bird is the second most lethal three-point shooter of my lifetime. I've thought a lot about this.
Wow.
Steph's one mm-hmm. and Bird's two. Like when Pat Riley, who's been around the NBA since the 70s, five decades, says, if I needed someone to hit a shot to save my life, I pick Larry Bird.
Mm-hmm.
That dude was money.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was good. Last thing before we move on from this Boston-centric conversation. Yeah, I have no choice. Boston sports, once again, ruling our world. And you're a fan of a team in the NFC, so maybe you're not as offended by the possibility of the Patriots ending up in a Super Bowl. But I've been, yeah, I had Patriots fatigue. I had Tom Brady fatigue.
Did you?
Yeah.
I didn't.
Oh, I actively rooted against another one. By the end, I was probably rooting for greatness and stack them up and, wow, unbelievable. And I would say that I was rooting for the Buccaneers last year because they were the underdog too, right? But I'm absolutely rooting for what is now, like I said, the statistical favorite for our Super Bowl matchup, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, defending champions with Tom Brady against Bill Belichick and the New England Patriots. Like I mean, there's the talking heads will be all over it, but I don't. I need that. There's nothing close to what from a hype perspective would rival that. You think about the potential matchups.
Yeah. It would have to be the biggest Super Bowl rating viewership number ever, wouldn't mm-hmm. it?
I think. Biggest sporting event ever.
Ever.
Yeah. No, I'm all for it. Maybe
like
even
Brady Mahomes was huge, yeah. But this is another level.
Yeah. Might be bigger even than Raptors Thunder. Tonight.
Oh.
At Scotiabank Arena.
Oh.
Hey, the Thunder bounced back nicely after their 70-point loss in Memphis. They beat Detroit a couple of days later on a Monday night. So they're riding a one-game winning streak. You lose 152-79, but then win 114-103 in the Motor City on Monday. This is their next game tonight against the Raptors. I don't necessarily want to talk about the game all that much. Although there's, you know, it's cool to see a couple of featured Canadians for that Thunder team.
And then Friday RJ comes to town.
Yeah. So it's a good couple of days for Canadian basketball fans. Michael Grange wrote today on sportsnet.ca about the impending decisions that the Raptors are going to have to make because we're not too far away from trade season, which is mm-hmm. the deadline's not until February, but free agents that signed in the offseason are eligible to be traded coming up here in December. So that's when the conversations really start to take place. And I've, like, since the start of the season, I've tried to wrap my head around where the Raptors are in their development because it's so hard to figure out because was last year an aberration? What do you have here? You have a max player in Pascal Siakam. You have a very good player in OG Anunoby. You have a potential all-star in Fred VanVleet, and you have a very good selection at number four in Scotty Barnes. Add that all together, that seems like a pretty good start. But we haven't seen all those players play together all that much this season. And when they haven't blown us away. And it's an interesting trade deadline, too. Because as Grange outlines in his piece on sportsnet.ca, you have the potential for the Pacers to be sellers. You have the potential for a team like the Blazers either to be buyers, or if Dame Lillard says this is too much of a gong show, get me out of here, that they just strip it down, might end up being a buyer's market. And if that's the case, maybe you have a decision to make if you're Masai Ujiri and you're Bobby Webster that, okay, maybe you're not like going all in here or anything, but the idea of ponying up some not insignificant assets for like a Domantas Sabonis or a Miles Turner, like that might be on the table here in the coming days. It's a really, really tough decision because it could impact the next half decade of this franchise's development.
It's really fascinating because if you're thinking about being a buyer, what are you actually surrounding two assets with?
Mm-hmm.
You have Van Vliet, who's a bit of a shooter, a bit of a distributor. You have Siakam, who is an enigma. You have Barnes, who's 2 years away from really establishing him. We'll find out by the time he's a senior in college what he might be able to morph himself into at the NBA level. I just look at this team right now, and I wonder if two assets at that level, the Sabonis and the Turner, what does that make them?
Yeah, well, not a championship-level team,
God,
right?
God, no. Gets them into the second round?
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess at best this gets them into the conference finals, and I think that's far-fetched. This is a team that's kind of, they're half pregnant right now.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know what they want to be right now. And I understand that if it ends up being a seller's market, you want to get something for what you got. But if you go get something, what is that something?
Yeah. I think the best is you're right. You're like, what are you? And you're trying to be a championship team. That's it. That's the end goal. And does making it to the second round of the playoffs, does in 1 year, when you realize that that might be your ceiling, does that help you in any way take the next step? Because it's not like other sports where it's like, oh, baby steps. It's, do you have the guy? Do you have the core? But more specifically, do you have the guy? I think the most logical route to the Raptors being that thing that Masai Ujiri wants them to be and only cares about them being is if Scottie Barnes emerges as that guy. Because I think at this point we understand that, yeah, while Pascal Siakam might be an enigma, and he's a good player, like, and yeah, dragging him as if he's not is stupid. Like, mm-hmm. He's obviously a good player. He's second best player on a team that won a championship at times. Yes. Like, second best scorer, at least, on that 2019 team. And any team that was in a championship contention window would be lucky to have him. But he's not going to lead you to a championship.
Pascal's a 2A.
100%.
Being paid number one money.
Yeah. And you kind of had to do it because he had established himself numbers-wise. And OG is a nice player. Hard to imagine him being that guy. I'm not saying Scottie Barnes is, and even as a number four overall selection and a guy who could be rookie of the year, like, the odds are stacked against him. But that, at this point, because there's only two ways to do it in the NBA. It's either draft that guy or trade for that guy or get that guy through free agency. And I think we know option three is not open to the Raptors. We thought it was with Giannis, but that door was closed rather quickly. So it's an interesting one. Like, you have to make this, and it's not a fair timeline that you have to make this decision in, because the evidence, you don't have enough of all these guys even playing together, but you have to make it quickly. That's why it's really interesting to watch this team for like the next month.
Yeah, it really is. I just don't see Scottie Barnes emerging right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's unfair to ask him right now in his first year in the NBA to end up being somebody that you want to count on in his first playoffs to go be a performer for you.
Yeah.
And I don't think Siakam's going to be that. So I don't know who's going to be that. And adding supplemental pieces, where does that get you?
Well, if Scottie Barnes, if you think he can be one day, maybe that is where the incremental thing is good. Like, maybe it is good to get him a playoff round or two if you think eventually he's going to be an MVP caliber guy. Anyways, talk about it tomorrow. Fan Drive Time. This has been The Fan Drive Time. Ben Ennis, Rash Madani, Sports at 590 The Fan.